In this second half of the fifth chapter, quite a short passage, but we'll look at three other passages later on in the message. The second of these sanctities has to do with our emotional life, with our loves, and with our affections. In Matthew 5 and 27. And in verses 29 and 30, Christ is referring to the radical answer. You have heard that it was said in the Old Testament law, "You shall not commit adultery," part of the Ten Commandments. But I say to you, making that law an inward thing rather than an outward thing, that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. You notice that the onus here is on the man. Because in that world, it was a very male-dominated world, it was a very patriarchal world, and although many people think that the Bible is hard on women, the Bible can also be very hard on men, because they are looked upon as leaders in families and community, and therefore their responsibility is all the greater. I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And here is the radical answer. It's a reference, of course, to consecration. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it away. It is better that you should lose one of your members than that your whole body should be thrown into hell. Notice that there will be bodies in hell, just as there will be bodies in heaven. And if in this matter of adultery your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better that you should lose one of your members than that your whole body should go into hell. Amen. The Lord will bless the reading of his word and give us an understanding of it. In our study of the Sermon on the Mount, we come this evening to the teaching of Christ on the question of adultery. In fact, this is the second of the six sanctities that Jesus is speaking about here in the second half of chapter 5. And these sanctities are areas of life in which God has a special interest and concern, since to violate the sanctity is reckoned by God to be a violation of the very life of God himself. Now, each of these six passages in the sermon is prefixed by the words, "You have heard that it was said to the men of old," and Jesus refers to the teaching of the law, the Ten Commandments, and the moral law of God in the Old Testament. And then he says, "But I say unto you," and you find that phrase at verses 21, 27, 31, 33, 38, and 43. Six times he says it. "You have heard that it was said to the men of old, but I say unto you." Now, of course, Jesus is not setting himself up against Moses and the teaching of the Old Testament. In fact, he's just told us in verse 17 that he has not come to abolish the Old Testament law or to destroy the teaching of the Old Testament prophets. He has come to fulfill them, or to fill them to the full. And here he is in these six sanctities filling to the full the teaching of the Old Testament on, for example, at verse 21, the question of murder and of hatred. This evening, at verse 27, it's the question of adultery, the sanctity of our emotional life. Question of murder has to do with the sanctity of life. Adultery has to do with the sanctity of our emotional lives. In verse 31, he turns to the question of divorce and remarriage, which are separate subjects, divorce and the remarriage of divorced persons, the sanctity of marriage. In verse 33, he turns to the question of the swearing of vows and oaths and promises, the sanctity of truth. In verse 38, he turns to the question of wrath and the temptation to get our own back, the sanctity of revenge. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. And then lastly, at verse 43, there is the question of not being hateful towards one's enemies, the sanctity of love, the sanctity of life, of our emotional lives, of marriage, of truth, of revenge, and of love. And in these six, Jesus is really making for the word perfect in the last verse of this chapter. You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And the next chapter is in fact a development of that word perfect. And Jesus gives us illustrations of what perfection should be like in religion. Perfection in our giving, perfection in our praying, perfection in our self-denial, and so on. We look then this evening at the second of these sanctities. The whole business of moral impurity in the broader context of the sanctity of our emotional life. The area of our loves and our affections is apparently especially holy to the Lord, and it should be reserved and guarded and kept firstly for Him. Your body and the loves and the affections within it are a citadel to be defended, because it, your body, and they, your loves and affections, are ceaselessly being assailed by evil men and by the evil one, whose end is the corruption of innocence. Satan loves to corrupt innocence. That is why Satan would be far more interested, say, in a young lassie or a young laddie, comparatively innocent, than in an experienced lecher or a roué. You see, the experienced lecher or the roué already belongs to Satan, but it is the latter too, the young girl or the young lad, that make for him a delicious meal in hell. That is why the corruption of the young is one of the most ghastly and heinous sins in the world, which is something that lies at the heart of so many of the money-spinning industries of our generation, I think of the sex shops. Who on earth can tell where these magazines are to go? They are already being circulated round the schools in Inverness. Or the violent movies. Or the pornographic films on video. Who on earth can say who is to watch and who is not to watch a pornographic video? No wonder our own Dr. MacDonald describes the television set as the Trojan horse of our generation. You remember, Troy was presented with a horse. It was a gift from the Greeks. That has led to the saying, beware of the Greeks when they come bearing gifts. Because, of course, the horse was full of soldiers. And Troy was destroyed from the inside. And the end, you see, is the corruption of the young and the destruction of the young Adams and the young Eves in every age, and the fouling of the garden of God. And so what we think of this evening is this broad concept of the sacredness of our emotional lives, the loves and the desires and the longings and the affections inside us. And there are really four minor points that I'd like to make before I come to the major thrust. The four major minor points, if you get the point. They sort of prepare the way for the really big thing. First is this, rather obviously, a theme such as this should be thought of chastely and with a certain detachment and objectivity. At a and along with chastity of thinking about this subject, there should also be the avoidance of prudery. You know, there's a vast difference between being chaste and being prudish. A chaste person is someone who is pure in his mind and in his body, and who is not afraid of the worst in his own nature or in anyone else's nature. You see, his mind is clean, and that's why he can face the worst. But prudery is different and is often a disguise, and a hypocritical disguise at that, for a secret interest in the subject. A prude is someone who can show an outward revulsion at the horrid realities of perverted emotions, but who secretly cherishes a hidden interest in the aberrations and the sins that he himself condemns. Jesus, the sinless Lamb of God, was chaste. He was sinless in his thinking as well as sinless in his life. There was no blemish or spot in him anywhere, not in his mind and not in his deeds. Jesus was chaste, but he wasn't a prude. And that was why Jesus was able to face the worst in men and women. And he could stand before the vilest and the most degraded and fallen of sinners and show them not merely God's displeasure with their uncleanness, but also a way out of the private hells of their lusts and desires. Jesus was chaste, but he was not prudish. And that kind of frankness and honesty that you see in Jesus is a frankness and honesty that you find in the Old Testament prophets. You find in the books of prophecy in the Old Testament some of the most dreadful imagery borrowed from intimate emotional and sexual matters, used to describe the depths to which the church had sunk, the Old Testament Church of God. For example, Ezekiel could tell the congregation that it was a prostitute. He said, "You are old in your adulteries. You are practiced in your sin. You sell yourself to false lovers. And yet you're bored with your religious promiscuity." Strong language, don't you think? Jeremiah could tell his audience that Israel had committed adultery with sticks and stones. The people were married to the idols they were worshipping. As Hosea said, Ephraim is joined to idols. That's to say, joined in marriage, sexually united to these sticks and stones to which they were saying their prayers. An adulterous relationship had been entered into between Israel, God's people, and the gods of the nations. And that was the sin at the heart of her apostasy and her departure from her own husband, who was Jehovah. So there certainly is plenty of chastity in the prophets, and chaste thinking and honesty. But there is no prudery. Chastity faces the worst and provides an answer and a way out like Jesus. Prudery simply clucks its tongues and condemns and censures and sits in judgment on the sinner. There is no hope for sinners in prudery. So that's the first point. A major, minor point. That this is a subject we need to face with chastity, without prudery. Second is this, and it also needs to be said loud and clear in the churches, that adultery is not the worst of sins. It is perhaps one of the more obvious sins, especially if there is an unwanted baby around, because an unwanted baby is a very visible and tangible evidence of sin. But adultery is a sin of the flesh, and the Bible is less hard on the sins of the flesh than it is on the sins of the Spirit. According to the Bible, and indeed according to Jesus, the spiritual sins are far worse and more reprehensible than the sins of the flesh. And by spiritual sins, I think of sins such as jealousy, malice, spite, backbiting, gossip, enmities, and pride. They don't produce babies. They don't force people to lie in the gutter on a Saturday evening. But they are all sins that are an offense to the majesty of God. After all, dear friends, Satan was not thrown out of heaven for his adultery, was he? Adulterers are poor adverts for hell. It is the jealous and the spiteful and the malicious and the backbiters and the gossips and the proud. These are the real adverts for hell, because they are the real sinners. The devil can have a good dinner out of them. But in the Bible, sins of the flesh are always treated with compassion and with understanding. The Bible doesn't excuse them, and it doesn't try to explain them away. It is simply less hard, as Jesus was with the woman taken in adultery. That's the second major minor point, that adultery is not the worst of sins. Thirdly, as C.S. Lewis points out in his book, The Four Loves, Christians really should face with a hearty smile the fact that the sexual appetite in man is one of the most preposterous and the ridiculous, and its value and its worth are grossly overrated because it is so insistent and so demanding. And Lewis draws attention to the fact that, after all, the sexual appetite in man is only one appetite, and there are other appetites in human nature, such as hunger for food and thirst for drink. But we don't put hunger and thirst on the throne of our lives in the way in which men put sexual appetites on the throne of their lives. And Lewis has a very vivid illustration in which he says, can you imagine a country in which people went to the theater? On the stage there is a table, and on the table there is a meat dish with a lid. And the curtains part, and the show consists of the lid slowly being raised to the sound of sensuous music, and the people gape, they gulp, they gasp. Eventually the lid is off, there it is, a slice of bacon. Would you not think, says Lewis, that in that country there was something wrong with men's appetite for food? Or you can substitute a glass of water for the slice of bacon. Picture the audience gaping and gawping and gasping while the lid was slowly lifted to the sound of music to reveal a glass of water. Would you not think there was something wrong with people's appetite for water? And here we are in our Western civilization, and we are using sexual appetites to sell razor blades, cars, toothpaste and suet puddings. Beautiful girls. They're always beautiful, aren't they? And handsome young men. They're always good-looking, aren't they? Smile at you. Sell your razor blades and cars and toothpaste and suet puddings. Don't you think that means there is something wrong with our appetites? That's part of the message of the world of the cinema with the film ratings for violence and impropriety and pornography now into our homes in the video world. Christians should face with a smile on their faces the fact that the sexual appetite is only one amongst many and can be one of the most ridiculous appetites in man. And fourthly, the fourth major minor point is that adultery is a good thing gone wrong. In fact, to adulterate is a good English verb. It means to take a thing of excellence and of quality and of beauty and spoil it by addition. To adulterate means to falsify by admixture. If you take butter and margarine, mix them together for the sake of thrift, you have adulterated the butter. If you take milk and water for the sake of thrift and mix them, you have adulterated the milk. And that is what adultery is. It is the cheapening of something that is God-given and noble. And in fact, although adultery is one of the seven deadly sins, lust, you can go through the seven deadly sins, and at the heart of every deadly sin, there is a virtue gone wrong. Vice is virtue that has been perverted. For example, pride is independence gone wrong. Envy is healthy competitiveness gone wrong. Gluttony is the instinct of hunger gone wrong. Sloth, the need for rest gone wrong. And lust is the instinct for love gone wrong. At the heart of every vice, you will find a virtue that has been perverted. What does Jesus do here in verses 27 through to 30? Well, he does two things. He starts with the inwardness, and then he moves to the outwardness. You see, the Old Testament law started with the outwardness in verse 27. You've heard that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." Outward. Jesus says, no, it's the other way around. I say to you, it's an inward thing. Everyone who looks at a woman lustfully, he moves into the thought life and the imagination, the look, has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And from the inwardness, he moves to the outwardness of the deed. And I want to read now, very briefly, three passages in the Bible which illustrate what comes out of that chain the inwardness, the thought, the imagination, the look, leading to the outwardness, to the deed, and how adultery in man brings out four things. First is the guilt of sin. Second is an awareness of uncleanness. And third is deviousness. Try to hide it. Tell lies. You alter the watch. You make phone calls. You pull the blind. You lock the door. You become devious. You tell lies. And fourthly, there is awareness that by this sin you have alienated yourself from God and you need to be reconciled. The guilt of sin, uncleanness, deviousness, and alienation from God. Now, of course, the classical story of adultery is the story of David and Bathsheba. I want you to see how this all comes out there. Now we'll read a few verses from Psalm 51, which was written after the affair of David and Bathsheba. First of all, in 2 Samuel, chapter 11 and verse 1. Verse 1 is really a key to the whole story of David's adultery with Bathsheba. It's, of course, a longish story. It starts with a look. Well, actually it doesn't. It starts with David's indolence in verse 1. Then the indolence became a look, and the look became a deed, and out of the deed came not simply adultery, but a baby, and then the murder of Bathsheba's husband, and then David's disqualification from service. We speak about Solomon's temple. Actually, it should have been David's temple, the temple of David. But he wasn't allowed to build the temple because of the blood of Uriah the Hittite on his hands. In fact, according to all the evidence, the word blood was the last word that David spoke on his deathbed, which, to my mind, seems a very solemn way to end your life. My hands are full of blood. In the spring of the year, 2 Samuel 11 and 1. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go forth to battle, that's to say, it was the time for fighting wars, David sent Joab. Very, very unusual. Normally the king went with the general. But now you see, he's a big man. He's an important man now. He's become an executive. He sits at a desk, chromium plated. He's got secretaries, and telephones, there are buttons, and computers. He's the big man now. He's not the boy who used to keep the sheep away out in the hills. He's important now. So he doesn't fight. He sends the general. Oh, indolence. You know this, hard work is a salvation. Did you know that? Keeps you from doing a lot of wrong things. When people are indolent and lazy, it leads them into sin. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go forth to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, but not himself. They ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David, the executive, remained at Jerusalem. That was the scene. It's the scenario. And it happened, who arranged it? Satan. Late one afternoon, when David arose from his couch, that was a long siesta, even by Mid-Eastern standards. People have a snooze for half an hour, but they don't lie till late afternoon. Indolence! Late one afternoon, when David arose from his couch and was walking upon the roof of the king's house, he'd built a palace, that he saw, look, see, first the indolence, then the look. He saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. Some, you know, have questioned Bathsheba's innocence in this matter. One would have thought there might have been a bit more discretion in the lady. A little unwise to bathe publicly like this, don't you think? The woman was very beautiful. David sent and inquired about the woman. One said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife?" Oh, his heart went into his boots. The wife of Uriah the Hittite, a pagan from the Hittite Empire, who had become loyal to God and to David. We'll see his loyalty later on, this marvelous man. So David sent messengers, the executive, you see, and took her. And she came to him. How willingly or unwillingly, we don't know. Certainly her bathing was very public. And he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself from her uncleanness, which does suggest a little forwardness in the lady. Then she returned to her house, and the disaster struck. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am with child." So David sent word to Joab. Notice his manners have changed. There was a day when he would have been sorry at this point and gone to God. David sent word to Joab, expecting a baby. Oh, it's a minor problem, just as it is nowadays. It's a minor problem. There are ways, you know, of getting rid of babies. Send me Uriah the Hittite, this man from this pagan empire. Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab the general was doing, and how the people fared, and how the war prospered. Then David said to Uriah, "Dear man, you must be tired after the battle. Go down to your house and wash your feet," which is a Hebrew euphemism for conjugal privileges. "Have a rest. Go and have a few days with the wife." You see, he's trying to put the blame for the child onto Uriah. Devious. Sin makes people devious. Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a bribe, a present from the king. But Uriah, faithful watchman, slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his own house. Problem. When they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house and your wife. Uriah said to David, here's the quality of the man. It was this that angered God, that it was this quality man he killed. Uriah said, the ark and Israel and Judah live in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. I'm a soldier. Then David said to Uriah, remain here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Devious. David tried to get him drunk. David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank, so that David made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his Lord, but he did not go down to his house. Problems. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab, sent it by the hand of Uriah. Oh, isn't that awful? The cunning of it. He got Uriah to take the letter. In the letter he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him, that he may be struck down and die. And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And he was a valiant man. The men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite was slain also, but it was murder. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, when you finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger rises and if he says to you, why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone upon him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did you go so near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent to tell him. The messenger said to David, the man gained an advantage over us. The end of verse 24, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. David said to the messenger, thus shall you say to Joab, do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. It's just unlucky for Uriah, he happened to be there. The sword kills one and then the next one. Strengthen your attack upon the city and overthrow it and encourage him. When the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for her husband. When the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house. He had plenty of wives already. She became his wife and bore him a son, who later died. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. And the Lord sent Nathan to David. And Nathan's sermon revealed the blindness of David, who could not see that the man in the parable of the ewe lamb was himself. Nathan had to say to him, thou art the man. You're too blind to see it. You're the man. Now, when he had recovered, he wrote the 51st Psalm, part of which we started with this evening. Let's look at it and see the change. He uses some very radical words here. This psalm is parallel to Jesus' advice that It's better to pluck out your eye and cut off your hand and go to heaven a cripple than go to hell whole. Be a cripple and go to heaven rather than have a whole body and go to hell for adultery. Have mercy on me, O Lord. Remember the 4 points: the guilt of sin, uncleanness, deviousness, and alienation from God. And they are all got rid of in this great psalm. Have mercy on me, O God, according to thy steadfast love, according to thy abundant mercy. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. The word is scour. As you may take a Brillo pad, scour a pan, or vim, or mirror, some of these things, scour the pan. Scour me from my sin. He wants to be clean. For I know my transgressions, no more deviousness now. My sin is ever before me, guilt. Against thee only I have sinned, not just against the woman and her husband, but against thee, and done that which is evil in thy sight, so that thou art justified in thy sentence. They lost the baby, and blameless in thy judgment. Original sin, the guilt of sin. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. I was born a sinner. 6. An end to deviousness. Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward being, where Jesus puts it, you see. And therefore teach me wisdom in my secret heart, where Jesus puts it. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, scour me, scrub me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Fill me with joy and gladness, and let the bones which thou hast broken rejoice. Hide thy face from my sins, guilt, uncleanness. Blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and put a new and a right spirit within me. And then how evangelical it all is in 13. Once you've brought me up from the dead, I will teach transgressors thy ways. Evangelical. And sinners will return to thee because of me. Deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God. Uriah's blood in his hands. Thou God of my salvation, my tongue will sing aloud of thy deliverance.